I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
The purpose of this law is simple. There are those who are equal before God shall now also be equal in the polling booths.
The bill is passed without objection.
Disenfranchisement did not mean that black women sat down and waited for enlightenment when it came to voting rights.
Socially distanced voters snaking for blocks in Georgia, Texas, South Carolina, and North Carolina.
They don't want you voting in person. They don't want you voting early.
It's a matter of a violation of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. What I'm curious to see, do the Constitution of the United States mean anything?
I voted yesterday in person. It was the first day of early voting here in New York, and actually our first time voting early in a presidential election at all. We've not had that option. It's one of the changes that came out of a new progressive state legislature that swept into office a couple years ago. So it was kind of an event, you know? I mean, tens of thousands of people lined up outside places like Madison Square Garden and the Brooklyn Museum. A drumline even turned up at the Barclays Center. They, of course, killed it on Twitter. There was a sweet novelty to it all. But also, there was real emotion. As I walked up to the polling site and, yes, found a line wrapping around the block, I passed a young Afro-Latin couple with their little girl, maybe 5 or 6 years old. She and her dad were posing in front of the Vote Here sign as her mom took a picture of them and just beamed at them. I can't speak for everybody, obviously, but for a lot of black people, voting is more than picking your candidate or your party. It's less a statement about them over there, more a statement about us. Me. I am here. I will be counted. I will have a say in how this society is ordered. Nationally, more than 53 million people had already voted as of Friday. From Georgia to Pennsylvania to Wisconsin, several states are on track to break turnout records. The president has repeatedly and baselessly challenged the integrity of much of this voting. We've talked about that already on this show. But the anti-democracy wing of American politics, it existed long before this election. And even now, it involves a great deal more people than Donald Trump. So that's what we're going to talk about on this week's show. Later in the show, historian Carol Anderson is going to tell me the story of the modern war against voting. First, though, we're going to meet some of the people who have benefited from that war. Christopher Wirth has been investigating the lawyers.
The Thurgood Marshall Courthouse sits near the base of the Brooklyn Bridge in downtown Manhattan. It's an imposing, classical-style building that houses the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. There's a big set of granite steps at the front. There's a long row of four-story columns. And in October of last year, this court heard a case that a lot of people were paying attention to because of who the plaintiff was.
Donald J. Trump versus Cyrus R. Vance.
The president of the United States was fighting to keep his tax records from being turned over to the Manhattan district attorney. And his personal lawyer that day was a New Jersey native named William Consovoy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This appeal.
Consovoy is not a household name like, say, Rudy Giuliani or some of the other people in Trump's orbit.
We view the entire subpoena as an inappropriate fishing expedition.
But he attracted attention that day because the argument that he put forth was so provocative, so radical, that it would fundamentally change the way we understand presidential power in the Constitution if it were accepted.
Immunity extends certainly to the president, in our view.
Because what Consovoy told the court was that as long as the president is in office, he's immune from any criminal investigation.
Absolutely, you say.
Absolutely, yes.
Consovoy sounded very sure of himself in this hearing. And then one of the judges challenged him with a hypothetical scenario. It's one that Trump himself has perpetuated.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
What's your view on the Fifth Avenue example?
local authorities couldn't investigate, they couldn't do anything about it?
I think once a president is removed from office, any local authority, this is not a permanent immunity.
Well, I'm talking about while in office.
No.
That's the hypo. Nothing could be done. That's your position.
That is correct.
It was a preposterous argument that Consovoy ultimately lost, but William Consovoy is a rising star in Republican legal circles. He owns a small boutique law firm that's known for taking on controversial conservative causes. And in this election cycle, with all the complications of casting a ballot in a pandemic, Consovoy is now representing the Trump campaign and the Republican Party in a slew of voting-related cases.
He and his firm are very good lawyers.
So I spoke with Mark Elias. He's a leading elections lawyer for the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party. And he says hiring Consovoy has really marked this dramatic escalation in Republican efforts to limit access to the ballot.
The Republican Party and the conservative movement has been plagued over the years by some pretty crackpot lawyers. I sometimes joke that I have been blessed by my competition. And I do not feel blessed when I see Consovoy's name on the other side of it.
Since the start of the pandemic, Elias has repeatedly found himself fighting Consovoy in court. As Republicans have pledged to spend a war chest of more than $20 million this year on voting litigation.
It's extraordinary because a major political party has said, we're going to spend $20 million to fight against people's right to vote. And it is clear that in that battle, Consovoy is their field general and his law firm is their army.
Consovoy isn't in every single election-related case, but Elias says he appears to have a hand in the ones that matter most to the Republican Party and to the president. In Wisconsin, for example, key swing state for Trump in winning a second term, Consovoy's firm has been fighting to shorten the deadline for absentee ballots. His firm also sued California to try to prevent the state from mailing a ballot to every registered voter. And in Nevada, Consovoy kind of did the opposite. He was fighting Democratic efforts to expand the number of in-person polling sites.
The fact is, I can't find a single case in which Consovoy's firm or the Republican Party represented by anyone else is in favor of anyone having more voting rights. They oppose voting everywhere, on every ground. They don't want you voting by mail. They don't want you voting in person. They don't want you voting early. They are simply in court fighting against voting rights at every turn.
You know, I wanted to know more about William Consovoy. You know, who is this person who's willing to take on all this voting litigation, who's willing to stand in front of a court and say the president can shoot someone and not be prosecuted? And how far does his work with Trump go? So I called Consovoy's firm, tried to speak with him. Consovoy didn't respond to my request for an interview. But his father, Andrew, is also an attorney who was this really colorful, kind of notorious figure in New Jersey politics. And 30, 40 years ago, he ran with a number of people who would have been in Trump's circle at that time. And I wondered if he had any answers. Can I record for my story? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you sure?
Andrew Consovoy is probably best known for his stint as chairman of the New Jersey State Parole Board from the mid to late 90s. Which meant he was in charge of the system that decided who got to get out of prison and who didn't. And in 2000, he became the center of a police investigation into whether he'd used that power to fast-track members of the mob out of prison and whether he'd used those mob connections to get his son William a job on a construction site, although Andrew maintains he's innocent.
Yeah, I took some lunches, but I never did anybody a favor. And I still don't feel that I did anything wrong here. Not at all.
That investigation was eventually dropped. But before that, Andrew had worked on a number of political campaigns in New Jersey, including both of Tom Kaine's successful runs for governor, where he worked alongside Roger Ailes, who would go on to lead Fox News, and Roger Stone, who, of course, has worked for Donald Trump for decades.
But Roger Stone was a key player in 81, and I worked a lot with him. I was not at his level, but I got to know Roger very well.
Andrew says he even went to a party at Trump's house in Connecticut, but that he had nothing to do with introducing his son to the president. You know, William had gone to George Mason, now Antonin Scalia Law School. He'd clerked with Justice Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court. And it appears that he has found his way into Trump's world through his own conservative legal circles.
To think that my son could get to that level is a father's pride.
Has he been offered a job within the administration? What's your awareness of that?
There was talk from him that they were going to ask him to be in the Justice Department. But that's all I heard, and he turned him down, and that was that. But I happen to like Trump. He's been very nice to my son.
Now, you know, it may be that life outside the administration is just far more lucrative for someone like William Consovoy. FEC filings show the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee have paid Consovoy's firm, Consovoy McCarthy, just over $2 million over the past year. And his work with the campaign has largely centered around absentee and mail-in ballots. But Consovoy also represents conservative groups with deep pockets and with close ties to the president. And in his work with at least one of them, Consovoy has gone after the voter rolls themselves. So earlier this year, he sent letters to government officials in several states, Michigan, Colorado, Florida, that essentially said, you know, your voter registration rates are really high. We suspect that's because you're not removing dead people and people who've moved. That's a violation of federal law, and my client is going to sue if you don't begin removing voters from the rolls.
First of all, the very premise of this argument is that the registrations are too high, and that's a tell.
Eliza Swearenbecker is a voting rights lawyer at the Brennan Center for Justice.
The plaintiffs don't want full participation by the electorate, and they think high registration rates are a problem or a sign of something going wrong.
Now, Swearenbecker says legal threats like these are really common from conservative groups. And in many cases, they work, most notably in Ohio, where the Republican Secretary of State implemented this really robust process for purging tens of thousands of voters, primarily in Democratic-leaning districts. And in 2018, the Supreme Court said that was okay by a 5-4 vote. So given that history, I was curious how Republican election officials in Florida were responding to Consovoy. So I submitted a records request for emails between the agency and Consovoy's firm. And I was able to read a handful of responses to Consovoy's accusation. Three were from Republican election supervisors, and even they were contesting Consovoy's data. None would talk to me, but in one exchange, you see an election supervisor call Consovoy's claims, quote, completely unfounded, and that the data he's using discredit his claims.
The methodology being used in this letter is inherently flawed.
Swearenbecker says a federal court in Florida had already found calculations like the one Consovoy used to be misleading. And yet, she says, letters like his just keep coming.
Consovoy and McCarthy may be newer to this game, but they are attempting to bully jurisdictions, states, and localities into removing voters from the rolls in these aggressive, unwarranted purges.
Okay, so Christopher, that is the story of William Consovoy. As Mark Elias told you, he's the field general in Donald Trump's war on voting. But as I said at the top of the show, you know, there's a lot of people involved
right.
in enabling this attack on voting rights. So who else? Who are the other lawyers that are fighting this war?
Well, you know, there are dozens of lawyers out there who are fighting these types of cases. But certainly the largest by size, if you look at a firm, is Jones Day.
That's a notable firm. That's quite a big and famous firm.
Right. It's a really large firm. It represents a lot of big companies, but it also has very close ties to the Trump administration. So many people will remember Don McGahn, who was Trump's White House counsel during much of the Mueller investigation.
Right.
McGahn left Jones Day for that job, and he went right back to the firm after falling out with Trump. And that's true of about a dozen Jones Day attorneys that have rotated into the Justice Department and back to the company throughout Trump's term. In fact, Jones Day is a tenant in a building in San Francisco that Trump owns a 30% stake in at 555 California Street in San Francisco.
So how much money are we talking about here for Jones Day in terms of what they're making to represent the Trump campaign?
Yeah, you know, just, you know, by comparison, I'd mentioned Consovoy McCarthy has been paid just over $2 million from the Trump campaign and the RNC over the past year. Mm-hmm. Well, Jones Day has been paid over $18 million since Trump first launched his campaign 5 years ago. They were one of the first firms that were willing to work with him as a candidate. And that's if you include the joint fundraising committees between the Trump campaign and the Republican Party. Now, it's hard to tell exactly how much of that money is being spent on these types of voting rights cases that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But Jones Day has certainly taken on at least a few of them.
And so then I guess I wonder, like, what this means for a firm like that. They're a large firm. I know people who have worked for Jones Day, liberals mm-hmm. who I imagine wouldn't consider themselves representing Donald Trump. Has this impacted their reputation at all? Or,
yeah, you know, I have heard from some that, for example, recruiters have told me that they're finding that lawyers don't want to work for Jones Day because of the firm's closeness to Donald Trump. I reached out to the firm for a comment. They didn't get back to me. But as one lawyer who I spoke with put it, Jones Day represents a lot of, you know, these big industrial firms that might not mind that kind of proximity to the president and certainly would have benefited from the corporate tax cuts that Trump signed into law.
And see, this brings us back to sort of the point at the top of the show, but also, you know, what we've been talking about in a couple of episodes of the show, that it's this is not just about Donald Trump, this moment we're in, particularly this anti-democratic moment. There have been a lot of people who got something out of this and have, as a consequence, been enabling of it.
Right. And, you know, the bigger thing at stake here is not just the kind of trench warfare, state-by-state election-related litigation that we've been talking about, but it's also mm-hmm. about the Voting Rights Act itself. You know, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. It has been one of the most important pieces of legislation in protecting voting rights and making it possible for us to have a multiracial democracy in this country.
Right.
William Consovoy was a key player in the case Shelby County v. Holder that kicked the legs out from under one of the Voting Rights Act's most important provisions, Section 5, which required states with a history of racial discrimination to get permission from the Justice Department before making any changes to their election procedures. And now Consovoy and lawyers from Jones Day are involved in a new case that's going after the Voting Rights Act again, one that the Supreme Court will hear later this term. And given the Supreme Court that we have now, we could soon see a moment when the Voting Rights Act, as we know it, just doesn't exist anymore.
So how'd we get here? The Voting Rights Act, it worked, like, really well. It meaningfully expanded democracy. So then what happened? Historian Carol Anderson will tell me the story after a short break. We'll be right back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and I am thrilled to welcome back to our show historian Carol Anderson. Dr. Anderson is author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, among other books, and she's chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University in Atlanta. Dr. Anderson, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And, you know, the last time I spoke to you here, it was during the 2018 elections, and we were following the voter suppression efforts in the Georgia governor's race. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, as I look at sort of this remarkable early voting turnout that we're seeing in Georgia right now, it feels sort of like a continuation of that same campaign. Is that how it feels down there?
Yes, it does. It does. I think part of what you're seeing is that the issues of poll closures are still here, but what you're seeing is a resolve, a determination of the people to overcome every one of the barriers, including COVID-19, in order to be able to vote.
Well, I wonder, though, you know, when you you talk about that resolve and we see these long lines, where do you fall on the sort of spectrum of whether when you look at that, is it inspiring or is it enraging?
It's enraging. Oh, it's absolutely enraging. It is unconscionable that we would have 11-hour lines to vote. It makes no doggone sense that we would have 5 and 6 hour lines. And so, and what we know is that this is has been a longstanding strategy where you don't put enough resources into polling precincts that are overwhelmingly minority. So there was a study done in for the June primary here in Georgia, and it found that communities where 90% of the voters or more were white, they had about a 6-minute wait. Communities that were 90% or more minority, they had a 51-minute wait.
Wow.
Yeah. You don't do that by accident.
So that the lines themselves are a form of voter suppression.
Absolutely. You begin to think about when they say time is money, that it's a poll tax. It is a poll tax to have people stand in line for hours like that. When you begin to think about what happens on a work day, when you begin to think about what does it mean when you're going to be late to pick up your child from daycare and the fees that happen there. When you think about what it means in terms of everything else that has to be done that day, the toll that it takes on people. And mm-hmm. and so here you see, again, that determination. This election is so important that people mm-hmm. are having to make that choice.
I have decades worth of history I want you to walk me through here, so there's a lot to cover. But before we do that, I'm just curious for you. I mean, how did you get started studying this? Why did this become, why did voting rights and voter suppression become something that was the focus of your work?
I am a human rights scholar. I am attracted to the fractured citizenship of African Americans and how that came to be. And so the first few books really looked at that. And then came that 2016 election. And the pundits were saying, well, you know, Black folks just didn't show up. Well, they just didn't show up because, you know, they really weren't feeling Hillary because, you know, she's like, ooh, Hillary. And it enraged me because I knew that this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. And so to have a narrative basically of Black pathology, Black folks just didn't show up, instead of really looking at the structures and the policies that made that happen, that's how I got here.
Well, let's talk about how we all got here. So we've spent a lot of time on this show over the past year talking about Reconstruction and the constitutional amendments that came out of it, including the 15th Amendment, which, to remind everybody, says that you can't stop Black men, at least, from voting. And in your book, Dr. Anderson, you detail how Southern states in particular spent the next century after the 15th Amendment finding ways to get around it, using poll taxes and literacy tests and all the rest of it, right, to keep Black people from voting without naming race or gender, for that matter.
Yes.
And I just want to cite a couple of the stats you used to show just how total the success was in this regard. Mm-hmm. So in 1867, 66% of Black adults in Mississippi were registered to vote. 66%. And by 1955, just 4.3% of Black adults were registered, from 66% to 4.3%. And then you point out that in Alabama, there were counties by the time we got to the 60s where there were 0% of Black people registered to vote. And I don't know that people appreciate the totality of voter suppression before the Voting Rights Act came about, or really even what the law itself set out to do about that. So can you just explain the logic and the function of the Voting Rights Act when it came about in 1965? How did it respond to the numbers that I just gave?
Absolutely. And so the Voting Rights Act was landmark because it had that pre-clearance provision. And what that did was it said you have to, states that have a history of discriminating against their citizens have to get their voting laws okayed first. What that did is it prevented these states from implementing these racially discriminatory laws, having those laws take effect, having them cauterize the electorate. having them shut down access to the ballot box so that politicians who are getting elected are getting elected on these truncated, gnarled votes instead of by a full, vibrant democracy. What the Voting Rights Act did was it stepped in and said, not today, son. It said, before you go and change your requirements about what it's going to take to vote, or before you draw a line for your redistricting, before you start annexing these places to begin to diffuse the Black vote in a sea of white voters, before you do any of that mess, you got to come through us.
And the point was it was preventive. It was a really big part of it, right? That's what you're saying. Because there had already been in 1957 a law that tried to stop voter suppression and didn't work out because it wasn't preventative enough, right?
It wasn't preventive at all. What it was it was about litigation so that you think about this, you're in Mississippi and your voting rights have been denied. You have to sue. And then there's an investigation that's going to take over a year while you're Black and in Mississippi suing a white registrar. Right. And then there's a trial. And then the case, they would change the registrar or whatever, and the case would become moot and you'd have to go back all over again. So
assuming you survived all that.
Assuming you survived. So years of litigation meant that there was no change. And so that's what makes the Voting Rights Act so landmark, is because you have change.
Right. And it worked, right? I mean, this is something I think a lot of people don't also, I mean, just how rapidly it changed democracy in this country. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So in the early 1960s, for instance, there were only like 5% of Black Mississippians were registered to vote. 2 years after the Voting Rights Act, it was almost 60%. Imagine going from 5% to 60%, almost 60%.
In 2 years.
In 2 years. Wow. And you had federal electors who were going in, like in South Carolina, because South Carolina still wanted to do the literacy test. And the federal electors were like, no. And you began to see a change in South Carolina as you had federal electors there ensuring that the poll workers were not discriminating against Black citizens. That's the change. And you started seeing Black elected officials.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was it just Black voting? Is there any data that shows like what it did to voting overall and democracy overall?
Not that I know of, but I do know that with the time we get to like the 75 Reauthorization Act for the Voting Rights Act, is that they added language in there dealing with language discrimination. So part of what you see happening here is as a more thorough recognition of the barriers that are put in place in front of American citizens to stop them from voting. So it says that if you're in a county or in a region, an area that has a certain percentage of folks who speak a different language, and these American citizens have the right to vote, so you need to put your election materials in that language as well. I mean, this is how you broaden this democracy and get it vibrant.
And that's over a course of a decade.
Yeah, and that's why it was so threatening.
Yeah. Well, on the question of threatening, I mean, I think another thing I've heard you talk about that I don't think a lot of us appreciate, I didn't appreciate till I read your book, is just how rapidly white people turned against civil rights in general once Black people started voting. Can you talk about that?
Oh, my gosh. So by the time we get to we get the Civil Rights Act in 1964, that is about ending discrimination. And we get the Voting Rights Act in 65. By 65, 66, you have the majority of whites saying that we're moving too fast on civil rights issues, too fast. And this is just trying to redo the mess that happened during Reconstruction a century before. So a century is too fast. But what you also see happening here is that after that, the majority of whites have not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1964.
Since that time, since this law.
Yes. Yes.
You know, your previous book is called White Rage, and you talk there and other places about the idea that we understand white rage, that phrase as you use it, as only in the realm of physical violence. But that's not only or even the primary place that it shows up in American life.
No, no. White rage really is about the bureaucratic violence, the ways that policies and judicial decisions and laws and executive orders come down to undermine African Americans' access to their citizenship rights. And because it isn't that kind of physical violence, we often don't see it. You know, you think about it, it took the cataclysm on the Edmund Pettus Bridge for and the filming of Bloody Sunday that's cutting into nightly news programs to have people in America go, wait a minute, they're getting beaten because they're just trying to vote? Now, that it takes seeing visual violence to understand the depth of what literacy tests can do, to understand the depth of what poll taxes can do, to understand the depth of what good character clauses can do. That's white rage, the policies. And that's where we are is so much today, the kinds of policies that we don't see the physical death, but we are experiencing the civic death.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me jump ahead to 1988 in our story of voting. So despite the white rage backlash, democracy does in fact expand, as we've talked about. But then the presidential election of 1988 comes along. What happened in that election in terms of turnout?
Oh, that turnout was so low. That was the Bush one, H.W., yeah. And Dukakis. And that turnout was, I think, the lowest it had been since 1924 or something like that. I mean, it's just like, so there was this kind of like, Shaggy moment of like, oh my gosh, people aren't turning out. And so you saw this movement, particularly of the Democrats, to figure out how do we expand voter registration? Because registration, if voter registration is opaque, how do you get registered to vote? And if the place where you go is only open when you're at work, I mean, all of these barriers that were there. And so they started crafting legislation, what would become the National Voter Registration Act, to open up access to voter registration with the motor voter law. But there was.
And can I just, before you go forward with that law, so the lack of turnout that we were seeing there by 1988, there help me understand the sort of arc of turnout. So we get this spike in voting after the Voting Rights Act. Black people are now voting. You see that increase that you describe in a place like Mississippi. Mm-hmm. How long does that go on before it starts to dip, and why does it start to dip?
You know, one of the things we have to understand is that with the Voting Rights Act, there was immediate backlash. It wasn't like the Voting Rights Act got here and there was peace and joy and wonder in the land. Mm-hmm. Voting has been a consistent battle. We have had states continuing to try different maneuvers to block the vote. We have had voter intimidation happening where you have places that are hiring off-duty law enforcement to be in uniform and carry guns at the polling places. You have had them being in places where you're moving a polling place into the sheriff's office. I mean, all for the Black community, all of these things, all of these machinations are happening. This isn't smooth. This isn't easy. Voting is a battle in the United States.
Mm. Well, and I saw somewhere, is this correct, that part of it was that there, you know, well-off Black people and well-off people were voting, but lower-income folks, people who were not English speakers, that's where we were seeing the problem. Is that an accurate understanding?
That is accurate. And again, when registration is opaque, when registration can only happen between 8 and 3 or 8 and 5, when people are at work, when working class folks are at work and, you know, the place is open from Monday through Friday, it makes it difficult. It makes it difficult. And this is what the National Voter Registration Act, the motor voter law, was going after, was to open up access.
And so what did it do? What was, I mean, I think a lot of people might know the motor voter law, or at least people of my generation are familiar with that phrase. What was the motor voter law? Because it's kind of another huge deal in the story of democracy in the United States.
Yes. And what the motor voter law did was it said, you know, that instead of having to go to the Board of Elections to register to vote, when you're getting your driver's license or when you're getting your license plate, going to the Department of Motor Vehicles provides another space where you can register to vote. Wow. That opened up access. Registration went up by over a million new potential voters, as I recall, at that time. Yeah, I mean, this is no small thing. But you know, there was a poison pill in that thing, right?
Well, let's take a little break, and we're going to come back and talk about that poison pill that was buried in this otherwise successful law and how we're still swallowing it now.
Hey, everybody. Christopher Worth here from the United States of Anxiety. I told you earlier about William Consovoy and other lawyers who are litigating voting rights cases on behalf of the Trump campaign and the Republican Party. And I want to tell you about another podcast here at WNYC. It's called Trump Inc. And this week, they're looking at a number of people who've profited from Trump being in the White House, including William Consovoy. You can find it at wnycstudios.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks.
We had a bit of a cliffhanger here about the motor voter law of 1993. There was a poison pill inside it. I'm going to hold that cliffhanger for just another beat because I want to jump ahead and ask you, Dr. Anderson, about 2008. There's this kind of thing I feel like amongst Black people when we start talking about voting, just about where were you when you went to vote in 2008 for Obama's first election? Where were you in 2008? What do you have a memory of that?
What I remember is I was in Missouri at the time because I taught at the University of Missouri at the time. And I remember seeing the tallies come through. And I remember looking up to the heavens and saying, "Mommy, can you believe?" Wow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I hate to pivot from something so sweet, but you've also pointed out that, you know, this moment is the next big moment in white rage in terms of how it impacted our voting. Can you say a bit about that? You feel like that it was in the sort of immediate wake of Barack Obama's election that we saw just a real resurgence in voter suppression.
Oh, absolutely. You know, so we hear this narrative that, you know, how racist can America be because we put a Black man in the White House? And that talks about how racist because white voters overwhelmingly voted for Barack Obama. But as I mentioned earlier, that's not correct because the majority of white voters have not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1964. What Obama had was a sizable number of whites, not the majority, but he had an incredible ground game. And that brought millions upon millions of new voters to the polls. And they were overwhelmingly African-American, Hispanic, Asian-American, young, and the poor. That combination would become the hit list for voter suppression.
What was the language what language was inserted in there that became a problem and why was it there?
It dealt with the Republicans. So that's why there's a 5-year gap. The Republicans insisted, as they knew that this was really going to expand the electorate, they insisted on what they called voter maintenance. And voter maintenance meant that the secretaries of state had to go through and call their list of A, people who had died naturally, B, people who had moved out of the district or out of the state. But there was a C that said, you cannot remove people from the voter rolls simply because they haven't voted. And that C got ignored, and the Supreme Court allowed it to happen.
So there it is. It sits there until we get to 2000. People hear about the 2000 election, and they immediately think about Bush v. Gore. But in terms of voter suppression, there was a whole other election, the Missouri Senate race, that became really important. Indeed. You know, the best you can remember, can you sort of give it, what happened in that race that now really changed history of voting?
Yeah, so we had this election, because again, I was in Missouri at the time. We had this election where the Governor Mel Carnahan was actually, he had died, had been killed in a plane crash, but his name was on the ballot because he died too close to it, to the election. And Ashcroft, John Ashcroft, was his Republican opponent. And in this election, the St. Louis Board of Elections had illegally removed, purged almost 50,000 voters from the rolls. And these nearly 50,000 folks didn't know it. So they show up at the polls and their names are nowhere on the books. And they get sent down to the Board of Elections downtown. Hours go by and the polls are getting ready to close. So the Democrats sue. Now the Republicans are upset because they're saying they're going to try to steal the election. They're trying to steal the election. But the Democrats are suing because people have been illegally purged from the rolls and were denied their right to vote. The judge agreed and said the polls can stay open for 3 more hours. The Republicans came in right behind with the language of voter fraud, stealing the election, and that judge shut down the polls within 45 minutes. So the polls closed at 7:45. And from there, Senator Kit Bond, U.S. Senator Kit Bond, began really riding that hobby horse of massive, rampant voter fraud.
And this is really the introduction of this idea into our political lexicon, right? I mean, it's so familiar now. But it was after that election in the Bush administration and with Republicans and Senate that we first started really hearing this term, voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. And I think something I've heard you point out is that it's, you know, that the language of it was notable at the time, this idea of stealing, quote, elections in urban areas that were full of people of color.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. And so they created an organization. They kept talking about, you know, this is what's happening in St. Louis. This is what's happening in Cleveland and in Philadelphia. And you get this image of urban black criminals stealing, theft from good, honest, hardworking Americans, which, as we know, is coded as white. Because in this lexicon, good, honest, hardworking Americans just can't be black. But those who are stealing our elections, stealing our democracy. And the problem with that narrative, there's so many problems, but one with the narrative of massive rampant voter fraud in the cities is that it didn't exist. It just didn't exist. Kit Bond had said that there were dogs on the rolls voting. There were dead people on the rolls voting. And all of these people were using these vacant lot addresses to come back and vote multiple times using a different address. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the local newspaper, did a beautiful investigation of all of those charges and found that they didn't hold water. There was a dog on the rolls, Ritzy Meckler, right?
Ritzy gets a shout out.
Yeah, Ritzy gets a shout out. But Ritzy, nor Ren 10-10, nor Lassie, nor Fido voted in that election. With almost 50,000 people purged from the rolls, somehow the St. Louis Board of Elections left one dead man on the rolls.
But this stuck. This stuck despite the absurdity of the facts that you're laying out, Dr.
Yes.
Anderson, because, I mean, this is literally the conversation in this election right now, that there's going to be fraud.
Yes.
How did this manage to stick for now 20 years, I guess?
And I think it stuck because, one, it played to a larger vein in American society, that cities are corrupt, that cities are where bad things happen, that cities that have large segments of minority populations, you can expect that crime is just around the corner. And you had an incredible PR campaign where they're in Congress testifying and using the language of voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. And so if you say a lie enough times and you put it in the garb of respectability, of U.S. senators, of big-time lawyers, and you have the media that see this like flashing headline of voter fraud, voter fraud, and you don't do the kind of interrogation fully. Just stuck.
Well, and all of this leads up to the Supreme Court ruling that we discussed earlier in the show when the Supreme Court struck down the enforcement part of the Voting Rights Act, the key enforcement part of the Voting Rights Act. And the consequences of that were immediate. We've seen a lot of coverage of that ever since. And now, as Christopher Wirth reported, there is another case coming to the court that is going to again get the Voting Rights Act in all likelihood, given the likelihood of a 6-3 Supreme Court. What is the current proactive solution? So if the Voting Rights Act was the proactive response to the way in which the South got around the 15th Amendment, what is the current proactive solution to the fact that the Voting Rights Act appears to be on its way out?
There are several things. One, we have to know that the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk because he is the Senate Majority Leader. So we need to make him the Senate Minority Leader. And that is what this massive turnout, in spite of all of this voter suppression, can do. The other thing is that we really have to be cognizant of the need to rebalance the courts. What I'm seeing here, and I mean, Mitch McConnell was really clear today. He's like, these past 4 years have been about whatever happens in this election. We will be able, through our work on the courts, to control what goes on. So he's been very clear about what this is about. It reminds me of the courts after Reconstruction that gutted the 14th and the 15th Amendment, as well as the Force Acts and the Enforcement Acts, and said that the 13th Amendment's badges of servitude did not apply to Jim Crow segregation. So that's what they're setting up as a Reconstruction court to undo and to stop progressive legislation.
That's a chilling idea.
Yeah, so we have got to be cognizant of that scheme and be willing to use our constitutional authority to rebalance the courts.
In the last few minutes we have here, the really few seconds we have here, you end your book on a chapter called The Resistance. I want to end this here too.
Yes.
How do you feel going and watching these lines out here? They enrage you, but how do you feel about voting in Georgia for really the whole country, but particularly Georgia for the rest of this election?
I think it's going to be great. I think it's going to be with this massive turnout. And I just leave it with this. Paul Weyrich, who was the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, he said, I don't want everybody to vote because quite candidly, our leverage goes up as the voting populace goes down. Well, as our voting populace is going up, it's time to weaken that leverage.
Dr. Carol Anderson is author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, among other books. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you so much, Kai. Thank you.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Mirando were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Jenny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Frillman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. That's right, like the brothers. And as always, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org, or you can just tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.